last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And welcome to The Rest Is Money. So Robert and I are about to interview Dame Sharon White. Now, unlike most of the people we interview on this show, she is actually heading for unemployment. Not that she's going to be short of job offers, I should say, but she's going to be stepping down as the chair of John Lewis Partnership next year. And I'm sure she won't be short of job offers because Dame Sharon White has one of the most interesting CVs around. So after studying economics at Cambridge and UCL, she became a star of the civil service, starting out in the Treasury and then rising to second permanent secretary. She was the first person of colour and only the second woman to do so. Alongside that, she's also worked in the British Embassy in Washington. She was part of Tony Blair's policy unit at Number 10 and was the Director General for International Development. So, loads with the government. But then after leaving Whitehall, she was appointed by Sajid Javid to run the media regulator Ofcom. And it was during her time as the boss there that it became as well the regulator of the BBC. Well, since then, she took quite a sideward step. We're going to ask her why shortly, into retail in 2020. But it turned out to be quite unfortunate timing. So here is our interview with Sharon White.
I thought I'd start with how it felt just a few weeks after becoming chair of John Lewis to have COVID hit. This was the worst crisis that any retailing organisation would have experienced probably since the Second World War. You'd never worked in retail. You had one of the biggest jobs in retail in the UK. And now you were facing this off-the-charts crisis. Did you have any moments of self-doubt?
I mean, it's interesting because when I look back now, I can almost not believe it sort of happened. So I'm not, it's one of the rare times in my life that I really wish I'd kept a diary. My appointment was announced in summer 2019. I joined the partnership early 2020. And the first decision I took with the team was essentially, do we close all the John Lewis stalls
before? The first decision.
I remember I got up on a Saturday morning and we were, you know, the organisation was quite lucky because we were sort of set up for hybrid working. Can't remember what the kids were doing. So I was, you know, it was a call at 9 o'clock. And we thought that formal lockdown was going to happen on the Tuesday or Wednesday. Remember, the schools had been announced to close the week before. So sort of all hell had broken loose, particularly in Waitrose on the grocery side. And I sat there thinking, you know, I've been in the organisation for 5 weeks, you know, just started to get to know the team. And I didn't know whether we were going to open again. So actually, even as we have this conversation, you're sort of starting actually just to sort of almost physically and emotionally remember. And of course it was tough. I mean, I had a long career before I started the partnership. So I'd lived through, you know, various sort of difficult moments in government, the financial crisis, the UK coming out of the ERM. So I've been used to today's normal, tomorrow is, oh my gosh, it's very difficult. So I'm sort of used to unexpected events. But no, it was nothing like it. In a way, I look back and think there was no playbook. So whether you'd been in retail for 25 years or 5 months, you know, I didn't know whether we could operate John Lewis as a 100% online business in 24 hours.
Is that the hardest decision you've ever had to make, or is that the hardest moment you've ever had in your career then?
I think the hardest moments are always those that affect people and feel very close. So we closed the John Lewis doors. We were hoping temporarily. I remember actually saying to the kids, you know, don't get too excited about being at home. You'll be, you know, lockdown will be over by May bank holiday. And obviously, you know, it was on and off for 2 years. So that sort of uncertainty was very difficult. But also we knew that there were going to be some very tough decisions, even without COVID, really, to get the partnership in a place of security. So,
and just to be clear, because you then permanently closed some stores.
Exactly.
Had the work already started before COVID? Had you come in essentially with a mandate to assess the sustainability of the business?
Yeah. So we had a sense, I mean, in a sense, unsurprising, we, you know, all with good intent, we grew nationally at a time when online took off just faster than anybody expected. So we, you know, very unfortunately for the communities and partners and customers, we had too many stalls. So the hardest decisions, going back to your question, Steph, you know, when you're in a room of partners, we call our employees partners. And I mean, I remember going to the Sheffield store, which is a very historic store. We've been in the community for decades. And we just announced a proposal to close. And I've been to Sheffield a few times. I'd had teams there before. And I remember going through the front entrance, and the entirety of the front, sort of front entrance, all glass, was covered in hearts. And there were hundreds of cut-out hearts by customers, members of the public, members of the community. I mean, it's very emotionally charged. You know it's the right decision in your head. You know that, you know, you can't find a way to sort of turn the store round. But it's communities, it's individuals. I had a partner who had worked there since he was 16, had worked 40 years. I was in a session for 3 hours. He didn't speak for 2.5 hours. And at the end of the session, he said, "Sharon, I've got something I need to read out to you," which is what this place meant. So, I mean, I think it's for every business person. If those decisions are easy, you're in the wrong job.
But you've got to detach yourself from that, though, haven't you, to
you
make
do.
The decisions. The thing that interested me during that time as well was the plan to kind of diversify. So it was less about retail. You know, there was the plans to do housing and, you know, rentals and things like that. What was that all about?
It's interesting because we're a very, very unusual business. We were set up as an alternative to communism in 1950. So the whole idea of the partnership is this sort of sense that you are a business that is almost like a sort of quasi-welfare state, that you're providing benefits and great service to customers, but it's a very unusual business. And part of what's very unusual is that we have no external shareholders. Mm. So the only money we have to sort of invest and grow the business, do a great job for our customers, is what we generate ourselves. And so the idea of diversification is something that's very historic for us. And we're a great retail business, and that's fantastic. And over the longer term, you get your sort of financial robustness and strength from broadening your base. Because if you're entirely consumer-facing, if you're entirely retail-facing, if something happens, you have a big crash, you've got no external shareholders to tap up. So my predecessors have done even the purchase of Waitrose, which was very controversial at the time, that, you know, department store is diversifying into grocery. The idea was that Waitrose was going to be the catering service for hotels, which, you know, Speed and Lewis, the founder. So that idea of your broadening to be stronger was always there at the beginning. And so diversification, and the original idea was to have 40% of our profit developed, and we're developing in financial services, we're developing through build to rent. Those activities will still continue. But, you know, when we set the target, interest rates were 0%.
Yeah.
They're now 5+. Inflation was on target at 2%. It went up to 11%. So we're focusing much more on ensuring that we've got really core, brilliant retail brands, but we'll still develop a family of complementary businesses, but it will take longer.
Because it did, I remember at the time, sound a bit mad though that John Lewis was going to be doing rentals. Was that like an easy sell to customers or to staff?
Yeah,
that was going to be another part of it.
I mean, interesting, for partners, totally got it, because they understand. I mean, yes, we're great retailers and we'll be even better retailers. And we also know that because of the nature of the business we are, if I want to buy a new business, I can't go to the city, can't really take on more debt. So you're always trying to find ways within the sort of adjacency and strength of your core business. And actually, we've been in housing since pre-war. You know, if you go down to Leckford in Hampshire, there's a village where we built basically all the houses with green doors, which were essentially sort of, you know, as a sort of housing village or park for retired partners.
Right. What happened to it then?
I mean, it's still there.
You talked about the unusual nature of your ownership. John Lewis is always cited by politicians as a model of how British business could be owned differently from the traditional shareholder model. Having lived it, is this model of essentially the staff owning a business, do you think it is possible to replicate that for other, I mean, obviously there are lots of other employee-owned businesses, but they're usually miles smaller. You're a vast business. Is it a model for other businesses?
I think it is. I mean, your point's completely right in terms of scale. So we are 76,000 partners, 21 million customers, and, you know, one in three British people shop with us. We are not just nationally, internationally, vastly, vastly bigger. And I spend a lot of time talking to other businesses who are thinking about going down an employee-owned route. And it's interesting, I was at an international conference in September, and I think there are a lot of businesses, often where you have a founder and a family, as, you know, the partnership was 50 years ago, and they don't want to become a public company. They want to keep the same ethos. There's a lot of interest, in continental Europe, a lot of interest in founder businesses. The scale is very different. So some of the big pluses from my experience of over the last 5 years, even during the very difficult moments, is that there really is a sense of, you know, it's my business and I'm really committed.
Can I ask you on that? As a chief executive, does that make it harder to lead? Because some have historically said 76,000 employees, they're never going to hold the chief executive to account. They can do what the chief executive or chairman can do what they like. Did you feel that it was that you had more freedom to do what you wanted, less freedom to do what you wanted? Had
I
just
think
personally,
it's,
what
I
was
think
it like?
It's unless you're in the partnership, it's really difficult to, because you sort of compare the chairman's role to the sort of, you know, chairman of a PLC.
The chair of John Lewis has way more power than the chair of a public company.
Exactly.
So different. That's just different.
It's just different, and actually, in the sense the naming convention doesn't help, because I am formally the chief trustee, so I'm responsible for the longevity of a partnership model.
You're effectively the chief executive.
You're effectively the chief executive. You're also responsible formally for the partnership having so-called distinctive character, being a special sort of business. And the other aspect, we're a democracy. So we are run on democratic principles, with some of our decisions being taken by an elected council.
Were you able to close the stores without approval from...
So it was a board decision, but there's a lot of consultation. I think that's really the answer to my question. It's not something's easier or harder. I would say it is because it is a very consultative, highly engaged workforce, it is a very consensual form of decision making. And that's not necessarily because a particular decision sits with your elected representatives. It's that partners are very, you know, you can't make a decision without lots of partners giving feedback, whether they think it's the right thing to do, whether they think it's a mistake. I mean, I liken it a little bit to the sort of parliamentary accountability I had as a government official. There's a huge amount of transparency.
Doesn't it mean it takes ages, though?
Both. So the sweet spot, and probably, you know, if I look, you know, I'm not sort of great looking back, but we've tried to bring an enormous amount of transparency. So whether you're working on the fish counter at my local Waitrose Holloway Road, or whether you're leading, you know, the Edinburgh John Lewis store, you know what the balance sheet looks like. Mm. You know what the profit target is for the next year. And so that transparency, when it works well, means that if we've deciding to grow Waitrose Convenience, or whether we're deciding that unfortunately we're having to sort of shutter a John Lewis store, you can see the context as shareholders. It's like operating in a parliamentary democracy.
Can I ask you a bit about the kind of John Lewis customer? Because, you know, growing up, We didn't have a John Lewis where I lived. John Lewis
where
to
did
me.
Did you grow up, Steph?
Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
So, and I remember saying to Andy Street one time, you know, do you think there's any hope? And he was like, there's no chance. And
that's tough.
Yeah. But I remember when I first started at the BBC, John Lewis was like the barometer of the high street. To me, it's really posh. Who is the John Lewis customer? Like, to me and like my family, going to John Lewis and maybe going to the cafe there or whatever else is literally like, that is a big deal. It's not a every Saturday you'd go.
And, you know, as North London Jews, you know, where else would you shop apart from John Lewis in Oxford Street?
Yeah.
As, you know, growing up, as yeah. it were. It does split the nation. Yes, it does.
And it's interesting because I, you know, my background, you probably know, my parents, the Windrush generation, I was born in the UK, grew up in East London. And I remember the first time I went to John Lewis was, I was 13 or 14. And the Brent Cross Shopping Centre, which is in Northwest London, had recently opened. I mean, there was a cooking competition at school, and I mean, as anybody knows me, I can't cook for toffees. And I wanted a special cake tin. And I remember saying to my dad, I don't know how I'd heard of John Lewis. I want to go to John Lewis to get my cake tin. Because even if the cake tastes terribly, which it did, could basically hardly eat it for the icing was rock hard, I'd been to John Lewis and I had a John Lewis bag. And I think for me, there is something about your shopping attitude rather than your background. So there's definitely something about if
so
you're...
So this showed you were upwardly mobile.
Upwardly, yeah. I don't know. But I think if you're, I think it's interesting because there was something about quality and I did. I felt, you know, I got off Leighton Station with my bag and I definitely felt, you know, there was a spring in my step. I mean, interesting, if you look at our customers and we grew customer numbers by about 1 million over the last year, it's actually very broad. So we have some one-time shoppers with us who are quite price savvy and shop a lot of fashion. And at the other end of the spectrum, you know, we're doing bespoke curtains made by hand in our textile mill near Preston.
How much were you hit when you got rid of the never knowingly undersold though? Because that was a kind of point of difference, wasn't it? This idea you could get, if you found it cheaper somewhere else, you could get the money back in 28 days.
And it's interesting. So we still price match. The issue we had with never knowingly undersold is also just it's a function of what's how our customers were shopping differently. So it only applied to stores. And even before the pandemic, 40% of sales were online. After the pandemic, 60% of our sales are online. And so we had a price promise that only applied to 40% of how our customers were shopping. So the reason for retiring it was essentially so we could be more competitive and price match more, but in the right way. Because obviously we also had, it's very difficult, the high street at the moment. You have not just a number of distressed competitors, you've got a number of big British names, big British brands who were there in 2019, 2020, who aren't there today. So it was really about how we give the best possible value to our customers, in a sense, without being locked into a price promise that was becoming decreasingly relevant to how our customers have shopped.
And we talked about difficult moments. You faced a confidence vote. You almost lost it. What was going on there?
Yeah, again, the background, and that's why I say sort of thinking about this as a bit of a parliamentary democracy. So we have a constitution. So those are the 30 pages of the rule book by how we believe we govern ourselves, values, principles, etc. But also how the chairman rightly is accountable, not to the board, but to partners through an elected council of 60 members. And the chairman gives a report to council twice a year. And that's been since, you know, 1919. So this is not new. So after half-year results, after full-year results, there's now a very important, quite a totemic moment. So all councillors are there. I've got hundreds of observers in the room. It's streamed. So I might have 2,000, 3,000 partners listening. Really important for transparency. And there's been a vote for the last 12, 13 years, not in the constitution, but sort of custom and practice. So the vote or the confidence vote is not new. And I've had 7, 8 since I started, everything from unanimity to it was a very difficult year. And so for me, again, it's less about the vote and it's more about is the chairman being responsive and properly held to account.
Was it very stressful?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So it's actually something I really like about the role and that maybe it's something about having been a public official and...
Yeah, because it's a very public role being the chair of John Lewis, isn't it? And, you know, there's been a lot written about you, you know, people suggesting that you're not up to the job because you haven't got the retail experience and then, you know, the years of losses, cancelling the staff bonuses, that type of thing. Does that upset you?
I mean, it's funny. The previous job I did at Ofcom, I learned very well to read very little personal press. So I read quite a lot about the partnership.
But this is your most public role in a long career.
Oh, yeah. And that's, in a sense, it was more public by far than my predecessors. And I think that's partly COVID. It's partly my background.
Do you like being more of a public figure, or does it go against the grain?
I would say it's a mixed blessing. Oh, right. You know, there are great things about it because it gives you a platform. You know, we've been able to do some amazing things, you know, not least in terms of we've got a big passion around more care leavers coming into the partnership. There's something about the accountability that's also really important. And there's accountability to customers as well as to partners. And also, to be frank, I've taken some difficult decisions that means the balance sheet is in a stronger position as it's been for years.
So then if you do see, I know you try and avoid it, but then you do see criticism, are you raging? I think personally, I'd never be able to be a business leader because I'd take everything too personally. Do you manage not to?
I mean, mostly, yes. I think if I were in my 30s, and I think definitely if I hadn't done the Ofcom job, which is, Robert, as you say, it was less public, but it was the big step forward for me because I'd been a backroom civil servant for over 20 years. And that was the first time, you know, you're taking some very difficult decisions.
And you're on the telly as well. You know, I interviewed you a few times on breakfast telly when you were doing Ofcom jobs. So you are out there.
I think if I stepped from being a civil servant into the partnership, it would have been much more of a pivot.
Just one other sort of interesting point that you raised. You say that in terms of the balance sheet, in terms of the financial structure of the business, it's stronger than it's been for many years. That is, to an extent, off the back of cancelling what most people would think of as the bonus, the partnership share for those 76,000 owners, employees. It's very hard. We see this in politics every single day, persuading people to take a long-term decision that involves a short-term sacrifice. How hard was it to get the message through to the owners, the partners, that the importance was to make sure John Lewis was around in 5-10 years' time, and that meant cancelling something they'd taken for granted, which was some extra income?
Yeah, and it's hard. And so this is exactly the right sort of terrain. It's the terrain of what's the right thing to do as opposed to the popular thing to do or the easy thing to do. So what we've said to partners is, and it is hard because, you know, many of my partners are part-time. The typical partners are part-time Waitrose worker, probably on about £20,000 a year, or a bit less. So this is not saying to people who are super, super, super well paid, but it goes back to the conversation, the engagement and the transparency, which is the choices. So we've made a choice, and actually we're investing record amounts in the next year. We've made a choice, which is to try to invest more in pay. So it's pay that you can rely on year after year in your base pay, not a bonus this year, because actually if I'm working in a Waitrose shop at the moment, my roof probably needs fixing and my refrigeration probably needs modernising. And so those conversations aren't straightforward, but I also think it's the right conversation. And I think really, Steph, that's probably the real answer to your question, which is I sleep really well because I also have a really strong sense of history and this period being a history when, you know, our net debt ratio next January will be the lowest it's been since time immemorial. And that gives my successor a great foundation, a great opportunity. And of course, I want the bonus to be back, but I also want the partnership to be here in 10, 15 years.
So why only do one term?
It was a really hard decision and lots of conversation with family. And I love the partnership. It's been, I would say that's the best thing I've ever done. And it's the hardest thing I've ever done. And it's the business that I felt sort of more emotionally connected to. And I also think it's a good pause moment. I think it's the right moment for me personally. I think it's also the right moment for the partnership to choose the right leader for the next phase. And I don't know what I will do next, but I feel, as I say, the last day is going to be very hard. But I feel it's a good moment.
Is it weird though when it gets announced you're leaving, but then you've still got basically another year to do before the person comes
in? It's still September, so it's a few months. It is a little bit weird because, you know, lots of people are obviously asking me about, you know, what I'm going to do next, and that's not where my headspace is yet.
Before we move on, can I just ask you as well, because you were really vocal a few months ago about shoplifting.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, has it got any better? Where are we at with it? Because, you know, all the retailers are talking about how much of this is a big problem.
Yeah, really vocal. And one of the big successes, so we were lobbying very hard. You may know there's a law in Scotland that's been on the statute books for a few years, which essentially there is a specific dedicated offence that if you abuse a shop worker is a specific offence. And the government announced last week that they were going to apply that nationally. So that's fantastic. We have, like lots of other retailers, put in place lots of measures essentially to make sure that our stores are still great places to shop and we're not turning them into fortresses, but there are more security measures. So probably a little bit easier than last year, but it's still a big issue right across retail.
Right, Sharon, Robert, I think we should have a quick break and yeah, we'll be back with more questions in a moment.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Try Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost, built for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, incredible load times, and 24/7 WordPress priority support, your sites will be lightning fast with global reach. And with Bluehost Cloud, your sites can handle surges in traffic no matter how big. Plus, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. Get started now at Bluehost.com.
So I wanted to sort of explore a little bit about where your values and sort of an ambition come from. You mentioned that your parents were the Windrush generation.
Yes.
And your career is sort of astonishing. You're at the Treasury, you run Ofcom, you're chair of John Lewis, but you come from, I don't know whether the term working class means anything these days to people, but, you know, most people would have said in the old days, working class background, first generation settlers here, your parents. Where did your extraordinary drive to succeed come from, do you think?
I mean, it's very odd because, sometimes I still think I don't know quite what I'm going to do when I grow up. I think it's something that never quite leaves you. And I think I've had a lot of luck and a lot of...
But when you were little, did you have sort of daydreams about what you were going to do?
So I guess the biggest thing for me is gratitude. So my mother left school when she was 11 and didn't really spend much time at school before then. She was the eldest of nine. And she was unlucky enough to be followed by five boys, which meant that basically every time her mother had a baby,
she had to look after. She stayed
at home. Was up at 4 o'clock in the morning, walking 2 miles to the river.
And this is in Jamaica?
This is in Jamaica. You know, there was no running water. When I visited my grandparents, age five, there's a latrine, two rooms. And my dad left school when he was 15. My mum could read, write less well. And so I never sort of think about myself having drive, but definitely that sense of work being really important. And the fact that I was able to go to school until I was 18 was the biggest privilege of my life because my parents hadn't really gone to school.
And you went to a comprehensive in East London?
Yeah, and I was very lucky because I was just in the catchment. So I went to a really good primary school and I went to two all-girls state schools, both brilliant, state comprehensive, but quite academic. And so my year, three girls went to Cambridge. Myself and a really good friend, Sunita Elaine, who became the first black woman to run a Cambridge college. She's doing an amazing job at Jesus. And my other very close friend, Ghazala, whose parents were from Mumbai, who's sort of become this sort of extraordinary holistic doctor for particularly for women who are going through sort of changes of life. So, yeah, we went up together, which was we were very lucky.
And where did the idea of going to Cambridge come from?
So I wanted to go to Cambridge from when I was the age of about 5 or 6.
How did that happen?
So, I mean, I used to watch the boat race with my dad because I grew up in East London, so Cambridge was closer. And I did, I was really a kind of nerdy. I used to, my dad bought encyclopedias home.
So does this come really from your dad? Was your dad very ambitious for you?
It's really interesting. So what I didn't have was that almost kind of classic immigrant, you're so lucky and, you know, education, you've got to work really hard. I don't think my mother had any idea what I was studying, but she knew I was in school. My mother worked really hard. And at the time I grew up.
What was
up,
she doing? What was
she worked in a factory for 40 years. My dad worked for British Rail for 45 years. And when I grew up, very few women worked. Only the black women worked because they were sending remittances home to the Caribbean. So work was a really big thing. Education was a really big thing. Being grateful, taking advantage of your opportunities, knowing even when I was at school how lucky I was to go to the school I went to. And then I had two or three teachers who were amazing. So my economics is my background. I had an amazing economics teacher who had grown up in Walthamstow, very close to where I grew up, gone to Cambridge, come back to teach in the local area. And he had this great phrase, which was, you know, about taking, taking the East End girl out of Leighton. So he had this great ambition that was probably greater than the ambition my parents really understood for me. And that even I had, I don't think I've planned my career, but I've had opportunities that I haven't been scared, I guess, to grasp.
What's interesting is I read that you say that if you hadn't have gone to Cambridge, you might not have kind of fitted in as well when you were working in the Treasury or understood the kind of language there as well. That, as someone who didn't go to Oxbridge and is from the northeast of England, blows my mind because it's like, that sounds really bad.
It was a great, so in some ways I was very lucky. So I went with, so there were two friends from school, so I wasn't by myself. The year above me, there were two friends who were at Cambridge. So it wasn't as though I was the first person from my school to have gone to Cambridge. I studied economics. There were 30 girls out of 300. Mm. And I think there were two black people in my year, myself and a friend from another college.
And I wouldn't be at all surprised if you were the only working class black person.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible to look back. I mean, I literally met about half a dozen people in the 3 years I was there who were black and from a state comprehensive school as opposed to a selective grammar school. And so it was this great translator because the vast majority of my friends, I mean, I met my husband at university, the vast majority of my friends were from selective schools, either private selective or state selective. And do you realise that even if you've got a more privileged, more financially secure background, everybody's just, it was a massive translator, particularly for the Treasury.
And can I just ask on the sort of background point, because we got on to the Treasury and there are lots of other things we want to ask you about that. But you talked about the Windrush generation. It wasn't that long ago that we discovered the scandal, as it were, of how that generation was treated by the Home Office, many of them deprived of citizenship. You know, some of them sent home in appalling, or sent home is the wrong way of putting it. Sorry, sent, it wasn't their home. This was their home. They were sent to, you know, back to the countries that they thought they'd left as criminals. How did you feel about that as somebody who'd actually worked in government and then you saw this massive miscarriage of justice affecting people like your parents?
Yeah, it's very distressing. I mean, there's a phrase that many immigrants use, and certainly my family talked about, which is the keeping the suitcase at the door, which is always that sense.
Did they feel insecure, your parents, do you think?
Yes. I mean, I remember when my parents had Jamaican citizenship. So my parents weren't affected by this sort of most recent episode. My mum died 10 years ago. But they were Jamaican citizens because, of course, when they came to England, they were coming home. They were coming to the mothership. My parents were, my dad's still alive, but, you know, that was the mother country and, you know, the Queen. And it was very, very important for them. So it wasn't, they weren't going abroad. They were coming to their roots in a way. But there was always that sense that you keep a suitcase at the door. Because I grew up during the 70s and the days of, you know, Enoch Powell and, you know, conversations about sort of repatriation. So there was always a sense of insecurity. And I remember, I must have still been at school, so maybe it was the sort of early 80s, when my parents, and I can't quite remember what the sort of political sort of context at the time was, but when my parents decided to get British citizenship, which was a process that took about, I don't know, a year, 18 months. And remember, I had to help my mum because my mum just sort of helping her to sort of navigate the system and fill in the documents and all the rest of it, because they had a worry that if they only had their Jamaican passport and Jamaican citizenship, one day somebody might knock on the door and that sort of metaphorical suitcase by the door, they might need to pack their bags. I mean, I never felt that myself, but that was something that was always, I think it is just, it is something. I mean, I look now, my mum emigrated when she was 19 and I have a 19-year-old.
Well, yeah.
And I find it sort of astonishing that she left her family, never really went back twice in her lifetime.
As somebody who devoted their career, well, a big part of their career,
yes,
to Whitehall,
yes,
did you have any sympathy with, at best, were absolutely appalling fuck-ups in the Home Office?
Yeah, it's a, I mean, they've, you know, I've read some of the review that was done and obviously, you know, they have rightly admitted, you know, that this was a big mistake. And obviously it's now a process of rectification and recompense. I think, you know, as I say, from a personal point of view, the biggest thing my parents did for me was to leave Jamaica. And in a sense, that's also a process that's quite a sort of disorienting environment, that you raise your family, you spend your adult life, your career, also in a country that you're not completely rooted to. And I think the miscarriage sort of plays into that,
yeah,
slightly sort of disorienting.
And as a parent then, does that, you know, is it something that's formed how you parent as well, like in terms of, how important is it to you to talk to your kids about the history of your family and things? Or is it kind of just like, that was then, this is now, it doesn't matter anymore?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because I almost start with myself, which is that I haven't really researched my history. And I lived in the States for a while, and I live very close to Howard University, which is the big African-American university that was doing lots of DNA testing. There was a period of my life when I was very thoughtful about finding out more about my roots and, you know, is it East Africa or West Africa, etc. And there's mixing in my family because my great-grandfather was white on my father's side. And I don't think about myself as Jamaican. You know, when you have to write on the form African Caribbean, it slightly jolts, because I think about myself as somebody who is British to the core, spent most of my life in London, feel incredibly privileged that that's my life, and my kids are British. And I respond to their questions, and my younger son is probably a little bit more conscious of his roots because he has a very close relationship with my father. But it doesn't, it's interesting, it doesn't feel very close to me in terms of how I parent my kids.
But it is interesting, this, I've thought about this a lot recently.
He's been on a journey, basically. He's been
has a journey.
We never use the journey word. We never use the journey cliche. But for a variety of reasons, I did do, you talk about DNA tests. I did a DNA test, and it is quite, even though I knew this about myself, when you see, because obviously, you know, my parents told me all where we came from in mostly Eastern Europe and we're all Jews and all the rest of it. But when you see in black and white on the DNA that you have no British DNA at all, I have zero DNA from the United Kingdom, zero.
Right? I've probably got more than you have.
It's possible. Yeah, yes. You probably do, yes. Right? I mean, I love this country like you. I have no problem with defining myself as British, but it massively changes the way you think about things like immigration, for example, I think. Well, it does for me, because not that long ago, every single member of my family was, you know, in Ukraine or Poland or Austria, every single one. So I'm interested in a way that, because this is, I mean, you know, for the moment, this is something I think about a lot, that you say you don't really.
Yeah, I'm almost intrigued by my lack of curiosity, and that may change. And I spent 5 years living in the States, and peculiarly that probably had even more of an impact on how I feel about myself, because I lived in DC. It was on one level very multicultural. I spent a lot of time in New York. Obviously, the African-American population, you know, much more significant than Black African, Black Caribbean population in the UK. And I've never felt so British.
I'm not bothered about looking into my past either. I think, I wonder if it's just because you're getting old, Robert.
Maybe when I hit Robert's age. So when did you, so is this literally in the last,
Yeah, the DNA thing is just the last few, sort of last couple of months or something. Okay. But
he's trying to find himself.
But actually, weirdly, Yeah, we'll have an entire episode to me going through my identity crisis. But actually, I've been going through an identity crisis literally from the moment I was born. So I think just maybe different people just have a different sort of approach to this whole issue of terrible word, but roots, I guess.
Yeah, but it may change for me. I think, you know, as I say, I grew up in the 70s, so I've always been used to being a minority everywhere, whether that's primary school, whether it's in my local street, whether it's in the playground, or whether it's at the nursery, or whether it's at work. And I don't know, maybe that will be my next chapter. Maybe when I, you know, maybe 10 years hence, suddenly I'll be get super curious. But I'm a very phlegmatic, very tomorrow.
That's a good thing, I think.
But let's talk about today.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you were, for years, what I think, you know, Michael Gove and Liz Truss would regard as the quintessential member of the blob, you know, senior civil servant, right? When you see her essentially making this argument, which she passionately believes in, that the civil service these days is on a mission to stop change, what do you think?
You're asking somebody who chose to spend more than two decades of their career in the civil service, and I don't recognise it. I think still the beauty of the civil service in this country, and again, I lived in the States where all senior levels of the equivalent are political appointees.
And she wants that. She says she wants political appointees.
And I don't, I mean, that's, you know, that's not my view. I worked for when I started the civil service, Mrs. Thatcher was prime minister. I've worked for the Conservatives. I've worked for New Labour. I've worked for Coalition, and I've worked for the Conservatives again. And that will be true for many of my former colleagues. And I think the beauty when there is a really good, connected, trusted relationship between politicians and civil servants. Civil servants want to do a brilliant job. And in my experience, and I was very lucky because most of my period was at the Treasury, and you have brilliant ministers. It's not party political point, whether that was George Osborne or Ken Clark.
There must have been times when you thought, this person doesn't know what they're doing.
I mean, genuinely, I mean, that may be, you know, I may have views on other departments, but the Treasury, I mean, you have very good, smart people. I mean, sometimes I have personal views that you leave at the door when you're advising. My experience, and this has probably changed since I left government, is that actually there was more difference within political parties than there was between political parties, particularly at cabinet level. So actually, if I look at the sort of work we did for Ken Clark, or the sort of work for Gordon Brown, or the sort of work for George Osborne, you've got basically sort of socially liberal, fiscally conservative politicians with very strong values, you know, linked to their, you know, there's a political centre of gravity. You know, I'm somebody who believes in institutions, and I'm somebody who believes in stability and continuity and transparency and accountability. And I think one of the strengths of the UK, and this, I'm talking about this as much as a business person who lived through, you know, the mini budget, is the predictability and the stability and the strength of our institutions, I think, is a great boon, whether that's for investment, whether that's people's sense of sort of confidence in living their lives, how public services are going to treat them, regardless of background, whether businesses can make 5 or 10 year investments. All of those things, I think, matter profoundly.
We just did a little mini series on the financial crisis during Liz Truss's brief tenure, and we argue that the Bank of England was incompetent in not seeing the so-called LDI pensions crisis coming and has not been properly held to account for that. And surely in a functioning democracy, whatever you think about, you know, most people would say Truss and Quarting were incompetent in many ways, but equally, has the Bank of England been held to account for what was a very significant mistake?
I mean, I'm not close enough to the bank. I think the general point about the accountability, I think there's a legitimate debate to be had at all levels. If you are a politician, if you're in charge of a public institution, if you're running a business, the accountability and the transparency, particularly in the world of social media and just greater transparency more generally, is incredibly important.
So in order to have confidence in the institutions that you say is really important, you do actually have to believe, if you're a citizen, that these institutions can't simply do what they like without, in a sense, redress if they get it wrong.
I think I completely agree on the accountability point. And I think the other, it's interesting you talk about the mini budget as a financial crisis, which is the first time I've sort of heard those words. So the other, I think, big context piece, and again, this comes back to the partnership and bonuses and transparency, is, you know, most citizens have not had a real terms pay increase, have not had a rise in their living standards since 2008. And indeed, whether you believe any of the predictions, are not due to be back to where we started until 2025. And for me, that is the real context for everything we're seeing in terms of lack of trust, lack of confidence. So we voted for you. We're a board that chose a leader. We're, in my sense, a set of partners who gave you confidence to continue the job, or we voted for a politician. And the basics, which is that, you know, I expect my children to be better off than me. I hope to, you know, hope they'll be able to live, rent, buy a house close to where they grew up, or get a job that's going to pay them more than their parents. Those basic elements of the social contract have come under profound pressure. And, you know, the whole debate about with a liberal democracy, I think, is massively tied up to that.
From listening to you speak, you know, you've got really kind of strong values. You clearly, you know, loved your time working in the Treasury and things. But it still really kind of alarms me that you think you wouldn't have perhaps done as well as if you hadn't have gone to Cambridge. So that just screams to me as there's a massive diversity problem in the Treasury. Do you think there is?
For me, in a sense, if I think about a theme personally and in terms of the roles I've done, including the partnership, it's about social mobility and the springboard for that.
And there isn't enough in this country.
And there isn't enough. And I've got this thing in my head about how do you take the kind of serendipity out of social mobility. So the serendipity for me was my economics teacher.
And that's so true. I mean, it was true of my dad as well. You know, he was an East End boy. He said he's dead now, that the only reason he ended up doing economics was exactly like you. He happened to have an economics teacher who inspired him. I think Andy Haldane has told me he went to a, you know, comprehensive in your part of the world.
Yeah.
And again, he says he just was lucky enough. He didn't do particularly well at school, but he happened to have an economics teacher who told him economics was about making people's lives better. And that inspired him.
I mean, I used to joke that the diversity in the Treasury was going to Cambridge rather than Oxford.
Yeah.
Because actually, the vast majority
were Oxford.
Close friends and colleagues were Oxford.
You, just on the wider context of skills, though, you've talked about this before in terms of the kind of staff coming into John Lewis, the partners, in that you don't necessarily think that kids are coming in work ready and that school's not preparing for them. And, you know, am I right in thinking you guys are having to do extra training to get them up to the level to be able to call?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the partnership, which goes back again to the roots of the partnership working brilliantly, even in difficult, good, bad times, is it has to be a springboard for social mobility. That is brilliant for our customers, brilliant service, and as a business, a springboard for social mobility. So that idea that you come in at 16 on the shop floor and you can go off and run Peter Jones. Mm. And, you know, one of the earliest people I met used to work in the equivalent of the canteen at Peter Jones and then went on to run John Lewis. So that is profoundly important. So in on the skills front, we're setting up our own apprenticeships. We're trying to sort of use the apprenticeship levy, which is the, in the sense of, sort of tax that businesses pay, in really creative ways. We are working, and this is not me, it's the team who are brilliant. So young people who have been brought up in very dislocated backgrounds, foster care, institutional residential care, in a sense, that's our sort of skills support and programme. 66 young people came into the business last year, even with all the changes. And we hope 350 young people will come in and get great skills and find a family and security and all those things that they haven't had. So how do we as a business take the serendipity out of their social mobility?
So you talked about the importance of the impartiality of the civil service. Didn't ask you what you felt about your former colleague Tom Scholar being sacked peremptorily by Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng. But there is one job which is in the gift of the Prime Minister, which is the Cabinet Secretary, the most important civil servant. Lots and lots of people say to me that if Keir Starmer becomes Prime Minister, he ought to beg you to go back and become Cabinet Secretary. If he begged you to become Cabinet Secretary, or if he offered it to you, would you be interested?
As I say, I have no idea what I'm going to do next. I mean, it's an extraordinary job, and I guess we'll see.
Okay, we will indeed that was see. I'm glad it's not a no.
Yeah, excellent.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for your
Sharon
time, Sharon.
Love to see you.
Thank you so much.
That's it from us on the Rest Is Money. Send us your thoughts, restismoney@gmail.com, or you can contact us on our social media pages as well. But that's it from us. Bye-bye.